I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The Book of Aaron is the new book from the author Jim Shepherd. One review of the book has hailed the book a masterpiece. He joins me now to talk about the book. The story is told by Aaron, who is 8 years old. When we first meet him, he is an interesting boy whose family is uprooted from the countryside and thrown into the Warsaw Ghetto in the midst of the Second World War. The book looks at the destruction at the hands of the Nazis and the general threat they placed on people like Aaron, children his age, their families around them, who are gradually disappearing. Aaron then encounters Dr. Janusz Korczak, a Jewish-Polish doctor who cared for orphans and who accompanied them on the train to Treblinka, the Nazi extermination camp. Jim Shepherd joins me now. He is the author of 6 previous novels and 4 collections of short stories. He teaches at Williams College in Massachusetts, and his writing has been published in sundry publications such as The New Yorker, The Atlantic, McSweeney's, Vice, and Playboy, among many others. The book is published here in Canada by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto today, Jim Shepherd. Mr. Shepherd, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
So Aaron has a line in the book that everyone starts off with big plans, then they figure out that's not how things are going to be. What was it like planning this book? How did you see Aaron, and what sort of plans did you have for him?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when you're writing about something like this, you're dealing with an actual historical situation. So you know that the children are going to be going to Treblinka at the end, and you know that Janusz Korczak is going to be going with them. So then it's a matter of what your narrator is going to do along with that narrative, and where and how you're going to bring things to a close, essentially. So whenever I get myself into these sorts of situations in terms of subject, I always find myself in a kind of a pleasurable aesthetic box of a situation where I think I've got some planning that seems like it's going to work, and other things I have to leave in abeyance until I move farther down the line and figure out the kind of patterns that are coming together.
Did you always see Aaron as the narrator?
I always saw Aaron as the narrator, yeah. The project originated, in fact, when an old student of mine asked me why I had never written about Korczak, and I told him that, in fact, I prefer the worm's eye view of history and that I rarely write about the great men and women of history. And then I went back out of curiosity and reread Korczak's Ghetto Diary, which I'm the sort of nerdy person would own. And when rereading it, I was struck by how miserable the orphans who were in his orphanage were. And it occurred to me that although, you know, there are lots of glowing tributes to him from the few orphans who survived, that at the time, of course, no one wanted to be there, and no one was happy being there. And that paradox interested me. So I thought, I think I want to try and write about that kind of child, you know, the child who feels unwanted by everybody and ungrateful for what he has, you know.
So where does this unwantedness come from? I mean, sure, there's the war going on around him, but I mean, the relationship with his parents, the mother and the father, what's that like?
I think part of what I've always been drawn to is the way, for me, the heartbreaking way in which children who are somewhat alienated can feel because of the apocalyptic nature of their emotions, like they're way more alienated than they actually are, you know. So I think he feels like a bit of an outsider, or more than a bit of an outsider, and I think that the way I imagine the book to work is you think, yeah, he's kind of an outsider because of the way he's treated by people, but he's also kind of an outsider because of the expectations he has for himself, you know. And I'm interested in the way that children and adolescents become complicitous in their own sadness and isolation, you know, because it's kind of a circular, self-defeating sort of thing that they get involved in.
And he's a sort of kid that even at 8, I mean, you can tell that he's a clever young man, that he's resourceful, and he's also a troublemaker, but, I mean, one would think that most kids were like that. And, well, I don't know. I mean, in terms of shaping him, I mean, where does he come from in terms of who he is?
Well, I think some of him comes from me, but some of him also comes from my sense of reading the primary documents and secondary sources as well, that the kids who were troublemakers are the kids who were more likely to be the ones who left school early or didn't do all their homework or knew the back way out of the town hall through the, you know, secret window or something, were the ones who were much more likely to thrive in a topsy-turvy world like the ghetto, where following the rules was going to get you killed, and where, you know, being a bit of an iconoclast might keep you alive, you know.
Well, what does he know about what's going on around him? I mean, we as the reader know how this all ends. For a child like him, does he know what'll happen?
I think what interested me also about a child's narration is the way it focused and heightened that quality that all Jews felt in the ghetto, I think, which was, you know, you're the frog in the pot, and the pot is heating up degree by degree, and you have a sense, a pretty palpable sense, that where all this is headed is bad, but you don't have a sense that you're boiling to death. You just have the sense that it's got a little bit hotter, essentially. And I think that the use of a child allowed me to sort of get at that tension between the way when you read a historical fiction about catastrophe, as a reader you know exactly where everything's going, and you have this vivid sense of what's coming down the road, but you also are aware that the characters in the fiction are opaque to that history. And that's always in some ways rebounded against the Jews in a way that was unpleasant, right? You always hear people asking that sort of ahistorical revisionist question, how could they not have known, you know? And besides the fact that, besides the answer that's often given to that question, which is, well, this was unprecedented, who could have guessed that this kind of thing was going to happen? There's also the plain simple reality of the sort of everyday quotidian misery that preoccupies so much of your energy. You know, if you're being eaten up by lice all day, when you hear that there's a new proclamation about what's going to happen in October, you may not be as focused on it as somebody should be.
Yeah, and so what's Aaron's goal then? Is it survival?
Aaron's goal, you know, I think Aaron's one of those kids that with an extremely low horizon, you know, so I'm not even sure he would put it in terms of my goal is survival. I think his goal is to do whatever gets him through the moment, and that might be, in one case, finding something to eat, but in another case, it might be trying to get one of the girls in his gang to not be cranky with him anymore, you know, or trying to get one of the boys in his gang to respect him a little more, or trying to alleviate some of Korshak's sadness when he's sitting with him in the middle of the night or whatever. You know, he's very much a creature of the moment, I think, and I think creatures of the moment it seems pretty clear that creatures of the moment had a big advantage when it came to surviving in the sort of day-to-day, continually changing environment of something like the ghetto.
And were there a lot of kids like Aaron? I mean, in terms of your research, did you encounter kids like him?
Yeah, in fact, a huge amount of the smuggling that went on, and of course the Jews only lived by smuggling because theoretically no food was coming in. A huge amount of the smuggling went on with children, because children were smaller and children were expendable, and you know, most of the ways in and out of the ghetto were like little rabbit holes, as I describe in the novel. So yeah, there were a huge number of children smugglers, and as you might guess, nearly all of them died, but not all of them, and some of the ones who survived I was able to interview and read and watch their interviews as well.
How does Aaron encounter Korshak?
One of the things Korshak would do besides run the orphanage was he would go out and beg for whatever he could emotionally blackmail out of Jews who were better off. Mm-hmm. And it was never very successful, but he was tireless in trying it, and he could usually guilt somebody into giving him something. And when he was on those trips, he would also keep an eye out and sort of do a triage in his head for those children who were on the street. And he would register which of those were already too far gone to save and which of those he thought were doing pretty well in terms of resourcefulness. And then if there was somebody in that middle ground who still could be saved but clearly wasn't going to make it much longer, he would bring that child. If he couldn't bring him to the orphanage, he would bring him to a sort of halfway a house, which was kind of just a room he maintained, and let them have a little bit of soup and warm up until maybe he could get them into the orphanage. And that's what happens to my protagonist.
And so he sees something else other than say, you know, it's someone to help. I mean, there is something. There is a bond between the two that develops.
There is, right? But it's not like a our eyes met across a crowded room kind of bond. It's something that grows fairly gradually as they both recognize each other as sort of fellow solitaires. One of the ways in which Daban begins is that they're both insomniacs, and so they're both up in the wee hours. Kurshak, by all accounts, slept very little. Our narrator has also, because he's arrived at the orphanage so recently, and because he's traumatized, and because he has no friends, he's sort of a night owl too. And they first start to engage each other when they're 4 a.m. when everybody else is asleep.
Well, what do you make of there was one review that I read that said that they would have liked to hear, say, Korshak's point of view on Aaron.
That I think is actually the dominant view. That was the New York Times reviewer, yeah. And it's one of those things, most writers are annoyed when they get a review where the person says, well, here's how I would have written the book. But in this case, it's actually a little more fundamental difference than that. This is really one of those forks in the road, I think, that defines the way you look at this kind of fiction, because there is, I think, an argument to be made. If you think, well, I want to know what the most powerful and interesting people were thinking, mm-hmm. wouldn't you want to, if you want to write about Gallipoli, wouldn't you want to write about Winston Churchill sitting in his destroyer with his, binoculars trained on the shore? How did the plan all become, begin, and all of that sort of stuff? And I'm much more drawn to the worm's eye view. I'm much more drawn to the poor schmo who has to carry out Churchill's orders, essentially. And, the reviewer for the Times is saying, well, Korshak would have been a very interesting person, and of course, obviously that's true. But I'm also interested in those people that got swept aside by history and are exactly the sort of person that reviewer would say, well, that person's not important enough to carry a book.
Yeah. Of the other reviewers, one review talked about how, actually a couple of them did, talked about how this book will be on that shelf of fiction to read about the Holocaust, and that there is much to learn in this book about it. After writing the book, what have you come away with in terms of perhaps insight on the Holocaust? And I mean, do you gain some wisdom on humanity perhaps in the process?
Well, you certainly teach yourself as you go, and if you don't, I think something's wrong, right? I mean, it's not as though I got to a point where I thought, well, now I'm so suffused with wisdom about the Holocaust, it's time for me to let other people know. I think what I did was I had done a lot of reading on that subject before, and had understood it in a kind of intellectual way, but I think what I tried to do was imagine an immersion inside it as a person who, in fact, wasn't fully aware of where all of this was headed. And again, I think one of the things that was quite revelatory to me was how much the experience was a matter of a kind of endurance test, how much of it was a kind of a quotidian suffering where you simply got worn down. You're worn down by fatigue, worn down by starvation, worn down by any number of other things, as opposed to a kind of hyper-dramatic thing where you go from one atrocity to another, And that aspect of it, I think, was one of the revelations of immersing myself in it. The preoccupation, for example, with lice by the diarists and the journal entries, and the sort of that sort of thing that we would, when we think about the Holocaust casually, we think, well, yeah, obviously that was probably a problem too, but mostly they must have been worried about being taken out by Germans and shot in the back of the head, weren't they? And
mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Did you encounter humor at all?
Oh, I encountered humor all the time. One of the questions I often get now that I'm touring on the book is, were you nervous about injecting humor into the Holocaust? And, of course, I didn't inject any humor into the Holocaust. What I've been trying to do is reflect the humor I find in the Holocaust. And it's not humor in the subject itself. It's humor in the way that the first-person accounts and the accounts of the time are trying to deal with the emotional trauma. I think that there's a way in which, with that kind of trauma, you either find the emotional resourcefulness to deal with it by becoming sociopathic and shutting down your emotions, or you start to, in some ways, find some solace in the absurdity of it and the ironies and that sort of thing. And you see that all the time in the original texts. I was talking to nonfiction writer Daniel Mendelsohn, who did his own book about trying to hunt up what happened to his family in mm-hmm. Eastern Poland during the Holocaust, and the book was called The Lost, and he related the story of interviewing an Auschwitz survivor and getting to the end of this his interview and saying, was there anything you want to add, there anything that I didn't ask you about? And she said sort of shyly, well, you know, I have the best Auschwitz joke. And he was sort of stunned and said, you have the best Auschwitz joke? What is it? And she said, I made it up. And he said, well, what is it? And she said, when she went back to Auschwitz for the first time, after having resisted doing so for 30 or 40 years, when she finally went back, she was standing in line outside the ladies' room, and a little Polish man asked her for a couple zlotys as a toilet attendant, and she said to him, you know, the last time I was in line here, it was free. And that's the kind of humor I think you encounter all the time when you read the texts, you know, that kind of mordant sort of black humor. And it was part of the way they the people trapped in such untenable positions dealt with being trapped in such a, it's, you know, it's a small way of demonstrating a little bit of power. It's a small way of saying fuck you to the universe. Yeah. It's, you know, it's any number of things.
Yeah. What do you make of the fact that for a lot of people, not just young people, but for a lot of people nowadays, Schindler's List is the only, say, experience they have with regards to the Holocaust?
Well, I think Schindler's List did a lot that is commendable. You know, I think there was a kind of enforced education that came along with going to see a movie like Schindler's List, and whether they liked it a lot of people who would say something like, well, I don't want to go see something depressing, were given a kind of enforced education about things like the liquidation of the Krakow ghetto, and those set pieces like that were very beautifully done, I think. But one of the reasons that so many people went to see it was that it was a movie that reassured them over and over again in quiet ways that the people they cared about were going to survive, and that the people they cared about were going to survive because of the actions of a few good men. And that's a deeply reassuring story. And while a lot of it is true, it's as a deeply reassuring story, it's stagglingly misleading about the nature of the Holocaust, obviously. I mean, the story of the Holocaust is a story of extermination. It's not the story of rescue. But the only way Steven Spielberg is going to make a movie about the Holocaust is if it's a story of rescue, obviously.
Yeah. Joshua Ferris, a former student of yours, said in a piece recently that you told him, I guess, or you've told your students, that to be a writer you have to admire other writers. Now, you've become someone who's widely admired, or there are a lot of people that admire you. What's that like?
What's it like to be admired?
Yeah.
Well, it's actually pretty wonderful to have writers that you admire say they admire you, and it's a little bit of compensation for being completely off the cultural map as a short story writer, for the most part. Essentially, my experience is the experience of feeling as though I'm invisible until every so often there'll be this flare of this sort of wonderful flare where a Tobias Wolff or a Jim Crace or a Karen Russell or somebody like that will send me a fan letter, and I'll just think, oh my God, that's so wonderful to know that I'm affecting people that I admire so much. But it's a very small community, obviously. You know, I've been being called a writer's writer for years, and I think that's a very polite code way of saying that not too many people read this guy.
So you've been teaching throughout all of this. Mm-hmm. You subscribe to the adage of, from your pupils you are taught?
Sure. I mean, it's not as though I continually go, wow, what a wonderful idea you just had, although God knows if you're working with good pupils that happens a fair amount. But trying to discipline your mind enough to present and articulate texts that you thought you understood pretty well to other people, especially smart other people, is a really good training in close reading. And training in close reading is a very useful way of helping yourself edit your own stuff. So although the teaching I've done over the years, I'm sure, has gobbled up a lot of time that would have been devoted to writing, I'm not sure that I wouldn't have been a much lesser writer had I not taught all these years.
Yeah, and reading, I guess, for you is a big part of that writing.
And reading is a big part of that writing, and reading a certain way is a big part of that writing. What I teach more than anything else is close reading, and I'm sure teaching that for so many years, some of that had to have rubbed off on me. You know?
Yeah. We've touched on some of the reviews of the book already. How does that affect your writing, if at all? I mean, do you take seriously some of the criticism, and if it's legitimate, of course, and does that influence how you would write, say, in the future?
Well, it's pretty rare that somebody in a review will tell me something that I didn't know about my work. Usually other writers or longer critical pieces might do that because they have more time to do it. You know, poor reviewers aren't given very much time to do this kind of thing. So usually what reviewers like and don't like, sometimes I agree with it, sometimes I don't, but it's very rare I'm sort of like, well, I never thought of that, you know. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, no, I'm not being reoriented by something I'm reading. There have been times with my third novel, a bad review in the New York Times essentially prevented any other reviews, and that meant the book sort of disappeared, and that meant that I was very sad about that. And of course, when you're very sad about that, you tend to not work as much. So that there, you know, that's a moment when reviews affected me simply by shutting me down for a little while because they had shut down a book that I had worked very hard on. But I think it's pretty uncommon for me or any of the writers I know to sort of go, well, you know, that in a review they said I was too glib, so maybe I'll be less glib, or they said I was, you know, not intellectual enough, so maybe I'll read Kierkegaard or something like that.
like the Times reviewed, I mean, does that frustrate you?
Well, it frustrates me because, you know, when somebody says, there's this novel about Germany. Well, I would have written about France. You know, you sort of go, well, okay, but what do you think of the novel that was written about Germany? You know, and to be fair to the reviewer said, I think when you choose a child, there's just a limited amount you can learn, and that seems perverse and frustrating. And you know, that's an opinion that I understand, but I don't agree with it, obviously, because I wrote the book I wrote. But it's not as though I find it revelatory that someone would say, well, I would have written a different kind of book. So, again, it's frustrating in that it helps narrow my readership, and I never want anything to do that.
But the reviews for this book have been quite good, haven't they?
They've been overwhelmingly sort of, they've been like the Ron Charles Washington Post thing, which is sort of, you know, embarrassingly hyperbolic. The first one that was measured at all with the Times, which is, of course, the most powerful one, so that's always the way it works.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure talking to you today, Jim. Congratulations on this book, and continued good luck with it.
Okay, well, thank you. Pleasure talking to you as well.
The book is called The Book of Aaron. It's from McClelland and Stewart. Its author, Jim Shepherd, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.